Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Luc Lalonde, a musician you may know from his band Born Ruffians or his own solo projects. He also co-stars in Pavan Mundy's new comedy Sundowners, making his acting debut as a hapless wedding photographer. Sundowners opens this Friday, August 25th at the TIFF Bell Lightbox. Luc picked Adaptation, Charlie Kaufman and Spike Jonze's masterful 2002 comedy about the contorted attempts of screenwriter Charlie Kaufman, played by Nicolas Cage, to turn Susan Orlean's The Orchid Thief into a Hollywood studio blockbuster while coping with interference from his needy twin brother Donald and, eventually, external pressure from the author and her subject John LaRoche, played respectively by Meryl Streep and Chris Cooper. We talk about Hall of Mirrors kind of movies on this podcast pretty often. I think people just like them and they come up a lot in conversation. Adaptation might be the perfect version of it. Everything refracts back on itself, through itself, and through Nicolas Cage's amazing dual performance. Chris Cooper won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, but Cage was pretty much deserving at least as much of Best Actor, and maybe two times, because it's a dual performance that's amazing. But, you know, awards aren't everything. Sometimes it's just enough to do the work. This is someone else's movie.
Just running through movies in my head of movies that I'd seen a lot, that I felt I could talk somewhat intelligently.
No, either way's right.
About both.
Yeah.
And I liked something that I saw kind of as I was coming of age. I saw, I guess when I was 16. It came out in 2002.
Yeah.
I was 16 when it came out. I remember seeing it shortly after it came out. I probably rented it. And I just remember it being, I saw it before. I think I went back and watched Being John Malkovich after. But it was one of those movies that changed the way I saw movies, I guess. Like, it has, it's so different. It had, up to that point, was so different than anything I'd ever seen. Mm-hmm. And it got me into Charlie Kaufman as a writer, because he writes himself into the movie and elevates himself beyond screenwriter to sure, something else. And it just put me on a path, I guess, of watching movies differently, I think. And so I just thought it'd be a really good one. And it's still one of my favorite movies. I rewatched it last night, and it's still just, I think, just so good. I just love it so much. I just wanted to pick something that I loved. So
that's good.
That was, just came, floated up to the top.
It's a good call, too. I mean, it's, I can't, I was trying to figure out how old I must have been. I would have been 34 when it came out, and I had already seen Being John. You know, I was aware of Kaufman, and I knew what he did, and still this was just so marvelously odd. Mm-hmm. It's so, I would love to have seen this when I was younger and more impressionable, right? Because you think going in as an adult, you know all the tricks, you know all the beats, you know pretty much what to expect. And 15 years later, now even, I don't think there is another movie that does that the way this does it. I mean, there was Identity, which pulls the twist from the three,
right,
6 months later, to the point where, and they were both released by the same studio, to the point where I was wondering, like, did Kaufman quickly come up with that and fold it in because he heard about that and thought it was a stupid idea? Because it's just as valid an interpretation as anything else.
Yeah.
That it's a reaction.
I also found out last night after looking at some Wikipedia articles that The Three was made into a book and then a film as well in 2003. Sorry, it wasn't made into out of this movie, but right, there was a book that came out called The Three with striking similarities to Donald Kaufman's,
really?
Screenplay.
Is it possible that Charlie or Donald planted that on Wikipedia?
I don't know.
Charlie as Donald has put that,
maybe,
on Wikipedia?
Maybe, but there's also a Wikipedia page for the film that was made for it. It has like 5% on Rotten Tomatoes and stuff.
I am not aware of this.
And there's like this big plot synopsis. It could all just be this elaborate, you know,
yeah,
because he put Donald as a screenwriter. He was nominated for Oscars and stuff, right?
Yeah.
So maybe it is just a continuation of that prank. I didn't dig too deep on it to try and find it, but it had like the cast listed and everything, and Maybe I'm just falling for their ruse.
It's okay. I don't mind if that extends into the real world like that.
Yeah.
It feels like that's what this movie should do.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And it does. I mean, there's something, because, yeah, being John Malkovich, he breaks all these rules that are set up, and he breaks them intentionally. Rules that I otherwise hate, like in Being John Malkovich. John Malkovich is in the title of the movie, obviously, so you know he's going to be in the film somehow. And, yeah, I remember seeing it, just being like, that's so strange, what is this even going to be? And I otherwise, like, I hate when that wall is broken in movies, when an actor, like in Ocean's 12 or whatever, when Julia Roberts is being Julia Roberts, I can't get around those kind of continuity errors where I'm just like, wait, hold on a minute.
Right, like your brain is fighting the movie.
Yeah. There's no mention of any of that up until that point, and it's just thrown in there so haphazardly that it's kind of like...
Oh, you mean that early scene where he just says, do you ever think she looks a little like, and they never quite get around. Like,
oh, they do say that?
Early in the first scenes of the second movie. It's not in Ocean's 11, but it is in 12.
So, okay.
It's this weird moment that just hangs there.
I just think it's kind of like... what's the word? See, this is another film term that I'm going to get wrong probably from adaptation as well. I mean, from a lot of films. The thing...
God from the Machine.
That's how I feel about that Julie Roberts play. But that's how I...
But it has her meet Bruce Willis, which is so great because they played fake versions of themselves in the player. Like, it's such a long... But when it happens...
I guess...
I'm botching the sports metaphor myself. I was saying, it's a big, long throw. But when it lands, it's just like, holy shit, they're playing fake... That's still fake Bruce Willis. Like, if we're in the world of the player, what does that mean?
So there's that, I guess one could argue. There's probably some elaborate fan theory online.
Oh, I'm sure.
That the Ocean's series of movies take place in some alternate reality, where Julie Roberts is a famous actor, but George Clooney, right. Matt Damon, Brad Pitt, you know, all of they're not in that reality.
Well,
only Julie Roberts exists.
There is actually evidence to support this. God help me, I'm going to go there. In the first one, in Ocean's 11, because it is my favorite moment in that entire movie, there's that poker game scene where Danny and Rusty, Clooney and Pitt, are playing poker with... I think Topher Grace and somebody else, but they're a couple of TV stars.
Yeah.
And when they leave the game, the TV stars get mobbed and George Clooney and Brad Pitt just walk away unnoticed and unbothered. So they're comment on that already.
They're very playful.
Those guys are the real stars and Danny, that's how Danny and Rusty can just walk away. They're not famous.
Yeah.
But it is like at the time, two of the biggest movie stars on the planet.
Okay.
Just having this little moment where they're playing nobodies.
You're pulling me over to this side, okay.
I'm telling you. There's concrete proof here.
And I like that kind of... I mean, I'm not saying I'm not a fan of... I like those Ocean movies. I'm a huge fan of The Sting. That's one of my favorite movies. Mm-hmm. And I think the Ocean's movies are like the modern version of that. Taking like these huge actors and doing this kind of fun heist movie where you just... It takes you on this really fun ride. Like, you don't... And they do it so well.
Well, Soderbergh told me once that those are his superhero movies. Like, they're the closest he thinks he'll ever come to making superhero movies because people have magic powers. It's the power of planning. It's just, I think he really admires people who can, because he makes movie after movie about it, people who can come up with these incredible schemes.
Huh.
But, they're delightful. They are. The whole trilogy, I'm a big, big fan.
Yeah.
They're here somewhere.
What do you think about they're rebooting it, right? With an
Ocean's 8
cast.
Yeah, the all-female cast, Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy, I think, are the two leads.
Are they?
Or is it Sandra Bullock and Cate Blanchett?
I'm not sure, actually.
I'm trying not to find out too much about it, but I'm looking forward to it. It's, you know, it sounds good. It sounds like a good idea. Why not? Heist movies are fun.
Yeah, so they're not remaking Ocean's 11, right? It's kind of an extension of that franchise.
Yeah.
It's a similar...
Well, the cast photo has all of them on a New York subway train, so hopefully that's going to divorce it completely.
Right. So it's like one of those things where they could have called it anything. They just chose to relate it to that franchise, so you know, like, this is a Soderbergh joint. It's going to be...
He's not directing it, though.
Oh, he's just like a producer or something?
Yeah, he's executive producer, I guess.
Okay.
But I'm in. I'm there. Why not? It sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Just, you know, a bunch of people using their weird skills.
Yeah.
And Logan Lucky is a lot of fun, which will have just opened by the time this episode comes out, his new film, which is also a heist picture.
by way of the Coens, kind of, because he's using Channing Tatum and Adam Driver and Riley Keough as sort of idiot siblings who aren't idiots. They're West Virginia coal folk,
okay,
who are planning a speedway heist, and of course much smarter. I think he's been watching Letterkenny. There's a real Letterkenny vibe to it, to the language.
Know.
Oh, it's that's Jared Kiso's show about people in the small town of Letterkenny. They shoot it up in Sudbury or Timmins or somewhere, and it's just this weird Central Ontario comedy. It's really fun. There's 3 seasons of it already.
Oh,
it's on Crave TV.
There's so many shows.
I
find out about a new show every day.
Yeah. Yeah, it's exhausting.
No,
but it's fun.
No offense to Letterkenny fans.
No, no.
But, okay, I'll check that out.
Yeah. And Logan Lucky does feel like the bastard child of the Ocean's movies, Letterkenny, and maybe Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
Cool.
Yeah, and well, in the best possible way.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. That sounds like something that I might like.
Yeah.
Cool.
And then that weirdly brings us back to adaptation in the idea that the properties, existing properties, are never enough for people, that you always need more. And the adaptation of The Orchid Thief, which was thought to be an unfilmable book, is what drove Kaufman to write this version of it, where almost out of spite it becomes a crime thriller and and a romance and a comedy and all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, I still don't know how he does it, some innate subtextual, metatextual thing, he lets me know while I'm watching his movie that he knows what kind of game the movie is playing with me. The film lets you in, it invites you, and I'm sure Spike Jonze is part of that too, because he's really good at this sort of direct communication storytelling.
Yes.
It happens in Her, definitely happens in Being John Malkovich, where the movie is letting you know when people are making mistakes, the movie's letting you know when it's okay to worry about somebody, and then in this case it's like, oh no, we know exactly what we're doing. There's a confidence to it that is just terrifying.
Yes.
I mean, how do you know you can make this work?
It's so well executed and so well written, and then the direction, like, it's just handled so flawlessly, and it's remarkable. Like, you watch it and it's letting you know. I think I was trying to remember the first time I saw it, and that feeling of those layers of the onion kind of unfolding before my eyes and going, oh wow. And then it's like one more, and then he's letting you know, he's kind of winking at you and showing himself and showing, like, his true intention with the movie, and giving you all of those things that he sets you up to hate, all of those things, right? He sets you up to kind of loathe his brother Donald. At least when I was, maybe I saw it when I was that age of very serious and very trying to find myself as just starting to become a songwriter, kind of, and but struggling with all those things that Charlie Kaufman struggles with in that movie, like having moments of, and I still struggle with this now watching it, I'm just like, this is still, I still very much identify with that. Breakthrough, you're inspired, and then cut to slapping your forehead, you're worthless, everything, right. You don't know anything about the world, you don't know anything about anything, what are you doing, you don't deserve to write anything about, and then breakthrough again, all you, like, that final breakthrough in the car, when he is sitting there, and it's like, all I am qualified to write about is myself, and he decides to write himself into the script, and you see how he lets you know. And he refers to himself as, I think, solipsistic and just that's one of the most narcissistic things you can do,
yeah,
thereby letting himself off the hook. Because you're sitting there, you could be watching the movie going like, this screenwriter's kind of he's really full of himself to write himself into the movie. But then, obviously, and I think I'm getting off topic from what you're talking about.
This is all relevant because of the nature of this movie.
Right, yeah, it's very revealing and honest and vulnerable, and I think that's why it's so good, and why any album or any book or whatever is so good. It doesn't hold back. In fact, it almost digs in deeper to his, because Charlie Kaufman is like a fit, kind of shorter guy with a nice full head of hair or whatever, but yeah. him and Nick Cage, and I don't know who would be involved, but like he creates this version of himself that's, you know, balding and bigger and more neurotic, more sweaty and nervous and whatever than Charlie Kaufman is, who is masturbating throughout the movie to these kind of embarrassing fantasies. And he's not afraid to like make people perceive him that way and kind of let it all, which I love. I think that's just so cool.
It's a pretty good jiu-jitsu tactic too, right? Like show yourself at your worst so people have nothing. Oh, I know I do this. I know this is me. Like right. You can't hurt me. Dan Harmon talks about this all the time. Like if he's the first person to call himself a fat idiot, no one else can. It's like, well, okay, but that still speaks to a basic self-loathing, right?
Right.
You're still acknowledging yourself as this debased version of yourself. I mean, even if this is Charlie Kaufman's worst case scenario, it's pretty worst. Like it's, and Donald, who becomes slicker, I guess, as the film progresses, he's the, I don't know how Charlie feels about that side of himself, the side that is Donald, because he's clearly the externalized version of the successful Charlie.
Right.
But I don't know if the ambivalence that Charlie has towards Donald as his talent, like rejecting everything and being, you know, screaming about the truth of everything and how important it is to be honest. And then still the movie we're watching is Donald's movie.
Right.
It's totally the movie that Donald wrote. By the end of it, it sort of detaches. It's like watching the Mantle brothers in Dead Ringers in a, wait, no, I'm making a mess of this. What I thought while I was watching this, like, oh, this is what the Mantle brothers would write once Beverly collapses from his own neurosis and Elliot picks it up and thinks, oh, I can fix it. It's the same kind of strange dynamics. There's no clear sign watching Adaptation again that Donald has fixed the script.
Right.
We don't know when that starts, but I think looking back, I'm trying to figure out on rewatching whether or not I'm supposed to conclude that this whole thing is Donald's script, that he has done a polish on Charlie's version. And so all the stuff about Charlie hating himself is actually how Donald sees Charlie.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then Donald gives himself the noble out, dying.
Right.
And he gets to be, like, because he's such a naive writer that he loves all of his own ideas. But then the movie validates the ideas as you watch them. So if Donnie wrote it, then of course it would.
Right.
Like, it's this incredible high-wire act of writing where the real Charlie Kaufman clearly knows what happened at every phase of the screenplay, but we're seeing, if I'm right, it's the polished of the polish of the one of the page one rewrite written by Donald as a way of shoving it in Charlie's face. Like, that's what this is. This is the victory lap that Donald is taking after getting full authorship.
Right. Because that makes a lot of sense. I mean, he writes Donald upon rewatching it now. As a 31-year-old, not a 16-year-old.
Right.
At 16, I think I hated Donald.
Okay.
I was like, you're just mainstream bullshit, whatever. Yeah, screw you. Charlie's the real deal. He's suffering for his art. And this time, Donald is a very sympathetic character. Charlie's always very mean to him. And you just kind of want him to just go give your brother a hug. He's just trying to get on his feet and write something. Yeah, he's not as talented as you, but you should be nice to him. Because of that, you should be really embracing the fact that he's going for it, that he's trying to write something and do something. Encourage him. And you're just, Charlie is kind of an awful character in the movie. And therefore, yeah, that makes sense that you're actually reading this Donald script. Or the
Donald's vision of Charlie.
That part of the real Charlie Kaufman's, which again is like very meta because it indicates the ultimate sort of self-loathing or because he's saying, like, this is who I am. Like, that's me. Like, I could be this other guy, but I'm just kind of awful. I'm kind of a prick or whatever, and a coward and all of these things. Like, until the very, very end. I don't know. I mean, the end is sort of, maybe he absorbs that part of his brother or something. He feels happiness for the first time or whatever, but...
And if Donald is writing it, then what you're seeing is you'll be sorry when I'm dead. Like that weird, simple sibling petulance of a kid who doesn't, you know, you don't like me enough. I'll show you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, yeah, either way, it's really fascinating. It's mm-hmm. it's this puzzle box. Every time I watch it, I'm staggered at its fluidity, at how easily it makes all of these transitions. And yeah, you were saying when you're watching it, you just can't believe it's happening. At the press screening I saw, there were maybe 15 of us in a small screening room, and every person was digesting and reacting to it differently on a different schedule. You would hear, every now and then, you'd hear someone else go, oh, or, oh. And I was doing it too, although I think I was just sitting there going, fuck me, look at this, they're doing it. But yeah, people, it's like listening to, it's like flashbulbs going off in a room, you just hear pow, pow, pow.
Right, right.
But never all in sync.
Yeah.
Everybody just processes it.
And there is nothing, there was something about that era, maybe it's just him, that early 2000s, late 90s. All of his movies from that time, and still, I'm still a huge fan. I liked Anomalisa a lot. Mm, I loved it.
Yeah.
I thought it was beautiful and just so strange and interesting. But there's no, and this is just, he's just so genius to me. I guess it's, you can't expect there to be, it's not like, oh, Hollywood's not making edgy, interesting movies. It's just, there's no other Charlie Coppins out there, maybe. There are, I'm not saying he's leagues above everybody else, but
no, he's, what a other singular movies
are
horse,
there even
though,
like that, yeah. You know, that are kind of that. And where it's, I think where its true brilliance is going back to all of that, how he embraces all those things and gives you the ending that the execs want, and you still like it. As somebody who watches a lot of movies, you still liked that ending,
oh,
right?
Yeah,
like,
sure.
He gives you kind of what you want. Gives that audience member what they want in spite of themselves, in spite of the fact that you might be sitting there the whole time going, yeah, it shouldn't go there, it shouldn't do those things, it should just be this kind of simple movie about, but then he gives you all these things and it's great, because a lot of the time I'll watch a movie, I don't like mainstream movies, whatever, those superhero movies, for example, or mm-hmm. I go see them for some reason, I hate them and I just talk shit about them and how much I hated them, and I can barely get through the last 20 minutes, half hour of those movies, or watching movies on planes. A lot of the times I'll just turn it off in the last 20 or 30 minutes because the endings are so boring. You know exactly where they're going to go.
Yeah.
But he somehow gives you the thing. You could have predicted where it's going, where it was going to go, maybe, but he gives it to you in a way that's so, it's so satisfying.
Yeah.
It's like, and it's so great, and I will always love the end of that movie, and that to me is the sign of a really, really good movie, is that the ending does deliver. Like the screenwriter he's a real screenwriter, the guy who goes to a seminar,
oh,
and
yes.
he's teaching his brother how to write, he's doing those big conferences or whatever,
Robert McKee,
yeah,
played by Brian Cox magnificently,
such a good scene,
who is that. Not Robert McKee at all. But yeah, okay. McKee has all these things about story and how screenwriting has to work and the requirements of genre and the things that you need. And I'm sure he has catchphrases that I refuse
right.
to even acknowledge.
And he says, get him in the final act or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's this thing.
Because if you mess that up, people are going to leave the theater. But that's what they'll remember, which.
Yeah, James Cameron talks about it, too.
He
calls it the recency effect. If you can land the last 20 minutes, it doesn't matter what else you did for the first 90, or in James Cameron's case, it's the first 2 hours.
Right.
It's just. Which you need to sell the ending.
I think that's taking your. I think that's underestimating your audience. I totally disagree with that, but it might. They might be talking about to get a hit or something, you know. Because it's kind of like music too. If you're really underestimating your audience that much, maybe you shouldn't be making. You know, like you should give the audience more credit.
Yeah.
You can't just be like, we'll just dangle some crap, whatever, blah blah blah, and then just make sure the ending's good, because that's all that matters, because people can't remember the first hour of the movie. Like, no, they're gonna be going, that first hour was crap, the ending was okay, so it's a crap movie.
Yeah.
You know, like
I rarely find myself rallying in the second half of a film I'm not enjoying, right?
Yeah.
But there are, I mean, you also, you know, like, well, you know when a movie peaks in the middle, that you've seen those too.
Yes.
Like we all have.
Oh, certainly.
So I think in terms of storytelling and drama, the human brain wants a big finish,
mm-hmm.
or a shattering moral lesson or something. Like, you mm-hmm. need to come out going, oh, that's what this was about.
Yeah.
But adaptation is about what it's about from the word go.
Yeah.
So even if by that measure, the ending being the ending that it is ingenious, because it is telling you the whole time that you're going to be pandered to
mm-hmm.
by the end. And then when the pandering comes, you can still appreciate the fact that it works dramatically while having the lantern hung on it, that it's still pandering. Like you, I think about Total Recall a lot when I think about adaptation, because it's another film that very clearly lays out what sort of movie you're going to see. And even there's a point where someone says, you know, like, oh, Blue Sky on Mars, to set up the ending, which is fine. But then there's also that point in the midsection of the film where someone comes in and does the info drop to Quaid, where he says, you're going, you know, your best friend's with the enemy, you're going to, up will be down, black will be white, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. And it all does. It all happens.
Right.
And it validates the idea that this is a dream.
Right.
That this is an engineered fantasy sequence that he's trapped in. And the whole point of Total Recall is it doesn't matter, because
right.
if it's happening to him, he's into it. And at the end of the film, you know, you're basically walking away from the end of Brazil with a guy comatose in a chair. We just don't see the chair.
Right.
And people are still fighting over whether or not it's a dream. Of course it's a dream. It told you it was a dream. Nobody sees adaptation and walks away confused unless they weren't paying attention.
Right.
But the movie is so elegant about telling you what's happening and why. The mm-hmm. why is more important, I think, for Kaufman. As an external screenwriter, just as in Eternal of the Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, it's not about the thing, it's about the guy holding on to his memories and how these two people are destined to be in love with each other forever, even if it's toxic.
Right.
Being John Malkovich isn't really about the portal, it's about being so blind to, like, the theme is there,
yeah.
but in adaptation, it literally tells you what the theme is from scene to scene mm-hmm. through Charlie whining. And through Donald being proven right. It's so great. It plays like a lecture without ever having a lecture. And then it has an actual lecture from
right.
McKee in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Just to remind you that this is what it's about.
Yeah.
Or what it's not about. It's about the impossibility of finding a story that satisfies, or the impossibility of adaptation, or, you know, in, as far as it relates to the Susan Orlean book, it is impossible to make a movie out of The Orchid Thief, because they did it, but it still is unfilmed, because it's not about that.
No.
But it kind of is.
It kind of, yeah. And that's another brilliant part of the movie, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because you leave it feeling like you saw an adaptation of The Orchid Thief somehow, because you get some version of that story, and those characters become so real, in part because of the performances of just an amazing cast, but
mm-hmm. yeah, we
you leave it feeling like
Cage,
you've seen...
Really.
Yeah. You've seen these three stories of John LaRoche, Chris Cooper's character, Meryl Streep playing the author, the Susan Orlean New Yorker writer, and Charlie Kaufman, who kind of eclipses them all. I wonder what the screen time is for, like, Nicolas Cage feels like the lead, and it feels more about Charlie Kaufman than anything else, which is very bold for a screenwriter.
Right.
I've read that when he handed the script in, he was extremely nervous. He didn't tell anybody that he was taking it that direction. He just finished it and handed it in. And also that he was terrified, kind of, or just nervous to meet the real Susan Orlean. And the first time they did meet was on set, apparently. And he walked... I think Spike Jonze or somebody was just like, oh, look at this, everybody. The real Susan Orlean and Charlie Kaufman meet for the first time. And she kind of laughed and was like, oh, this is embarrassing. And he said something like, something along the lines of, yeah, oh, this is embarrassing for you, this is very embarrassing for me, and he just, like, walked away. And he didn't, that was it. He was, like, he just couldn't handle it or whatever.
Hmm.
Because of what he had done, I guess, too.
Well,
as
a writer, right? Like, you'd have
yeah, that's
so
a
much
really
respect
bold,
in theory.
Yeah. I think, bold move putting himself out there, a very bold move to fictionalize Susan Orlean, use her name.
Mm-hmm.
And make up all the stuff about her, and kind of make her at times a not very likable character, right? Meryl Streep plays it so well, but towards the end, she's kind of pathetic too.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
just, she's addicted to drugs and she's trying to kill him, and you're just like, ah, oh, you kind of hate her as well. And that's very interesting that he was willing to take that character to those places as well. And it's great, but it's like, and she, yeah, I was trying to find a candid interview with her, the real Susan Orlean, where she talks about it. She's very, I think, kind and diplomatic about her answers. But I had to get the feeling that she's not super stoked with the fact that people are going to, whether or not you leave the movie knowing that's not the real her, you still, that that will eclipse the, you know, anybody that reads The New Yorker or whatever, well, exactly. And those are articles might kind of, but the movie version of her is going to probably be the one that goes down in history, right?
Yeah. Like, well, or just based on the metrics of how many people see a movie versus how many people read a book, right?
Yeah, like,
more exactly. people will think of Meryl Streep when they hear Susan Orlean's name.
Yeah, so that could be her legacy of, it's just really interesting.
That is
who plays it. She's such a likable character too. Meryl Streep plays it so well. I mean, and that scene where she does the first time she tries that weird drug, whatever, from the orchid.
Right.
It's probably it's one of my favorite scenes.
It is.
Where she's trying to get him to do the dial tone with her and she's brushing her teeth and things slow down and she's so good. Like she pulls you in to the movie. She's the type of actor where you're watching it and she's so famous and she's so known, you know her, but she pulls you in and you find yourself just like pulling you from your heart into her character and you're just so there with her and you completely forget the fact that you're watching a movie.
Yeah.
All the time.
Streep's greatest strength as an actor in comedies is that she shows you how much fun she's having as an actor without ever breaking character. And I don't know how she does it because it shouldn't make sense. Like, it should fight the concept, especially here where literally everything depends on you accepting what's on screen. Like, there are two Nicolas Cages running around in this movie and each one is differently eccentric and it is a magnificent performance.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. Yeah. I'm on Cage's side most of the time with his choices. I think he's a fascinating performer, and we talked when Bad Lieutenant came through, I got to interview him and it was great. It was great. We talked about his musical scale approach, which is like for Bad Lieutenant, he had to figure out exactly how high he is in any given scene, and they didn't shoot in sequence. So he graphed it out like a chart, like a musical scale, up, down, and everything in between. He needed to know exactly where he was, and it wasn't just I'm a two, I'm a three. It was, what is this drug doing to my up? What is this drug doing to my down? Can I speak through the makeup in this one thing? Like, it was incredibly detailed. And when you see adaptation, it's like, this is minor key, but it's just as thought through, it's just as intensely considered, and it's mesmerizing. And then you put Meryl Streep in there in full comic mode, and it doesn't shatter the illusion that you're watching two Nicolas Cages and a Meryl Streep and Hasey Chris Cooper doing his thing with the teeth. And just like, yeah, everybody in here is acting so differently and somehow in harmony.
Yeah.
And somehow the concept of the movie allows me to appreciate all of these notes that should be clashing up against each other. But instead, it's just like, look how high we're getting. Like, look how crazy we are going.
Yeah.
And we are not going to stop.
Yeah.
And then it all fits. It all meshes together.
Yeah. And it is a comedy, but it's not also, like, nobody's performance is pure comedy or anything, really. Like, it's all so genuine and heartfelt. And, man, Chris Cooper is so good in it and creates this kind of character that plays this kind of guy that I think everybody kind of knows somebody like this, a man or a woman, the really smart, dumb guy or something, very intelligent, has all of these, he kind of ADHD with his interests and absorbs everything and retains all this information, but is also kind of prone to vanity and he's so charming too, though, like, he makes that character so real, like, there's so many little things that he does that that are great when she gets in his van, kind of, and he's trying to impress her. So he's like, yeah, the van's a real piece of shit. I'm going to buy something cool when I hit the big time, though. And he's like, what kind of car are you driving? And she tells him what rental. And he's like, yeah, I'll probably get one of those, too. Like, in the way, there's just something so funny. And that's like the writing, but he just pulls it off in this way that it's just so brilliant. Like, he's just so, I don't know. Everything he does, he's great. But that role in particular is so, it's just so complete. Like, it's so good.
Yeah, it struck me as neediness. You know, like, he needs approval from everyone else. But his way through it is to just peacock.
Right.
So he's going to browbeat you into liking him. and it shouldn't work, but you like Cooper. So in the end, it works. I mean, it's the same reason that Streep can sell Orlean as a miserable, broken drug addict and still be charming and lovable, is because the actors are so committed to making you love them, the neediness. And it's the reverse. Again, it's like you could interpret it, or at least I interpret it, as Donald writing them as more pathetic because that's how Charlie feels. And so he's trying to give Charlie what Charlie thinks Charlie wants.
Right.
Or he's trying to honor Charlie's patheticness in this rewrite.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And either way, I'm really satisfied with it. Like, it's just, it's a pleasure to puzzle over these things because they keep giving. Like, there's so much, there's a vein of empathy and compassion inside the brotherly scorn that, yeah, is that what I'm supposed to take away? Is the real Charlie Kaufman writing an imaginary brother who respects him more than he respects the imaginary brother?
Right.
And why would he do that? And what does that mean? And where does this door go? And how does Spike Jonze feel about it? And I don't know. I don't know the answers, and I don't think I ever will. And I kind of like that. Like, I don't want them to tell me what they were thinking if I ever talk to them.
Do you think that there's... How strong do you think the aspect is of Donald versus Charlie representing simply two different parts of the industry of screenwriters, right, or two different sides of the coin of taste versus popularism or something? I don't know, like,
well,
like good taste versus bad taste.
Well, it's giving art house versus commercial, right? I mean, it really does boil down to that.
Yeah, I guess some people could watch it and just simply see it as that's all the brothers are. It's just the two sides of Charlie Kaufman, of good taste versus just doing something that I know people will like for money because I'm smart and I can do that too. And showing how he's denying that side of himself and he's giving you something more interesting or whatever, but then embracing them both. I mean, I guess just simply those two characters, like how much do you think that he was just trying to talk about that simply?
Yeah. I think they represent his, like, the twin poles of ambition.
Yeah.
You know, he really... I do think Charlie Kaufman wants to write a blockbuster. I think he wants to do that. And, of course, you know, casting Nicolas Cage after The Rock and The Rock and Con Air and all those movies that he made, and Face Off. Like, when he made this movie, he was kind of backswinging into independent and art cinema. But he was a $20 million man for a while. And I think the idea of having him in this little movie that's about the argument between art and commercialism, that's a choice as well. I think it's probably more about Jones making the choice to use him because Cage would have wanted to make the movie. It was up to the director to say yes or no, I think.
Yeah.
But
Tom Hanks was apparently considered for the part.
That's interesting. I don't know that that would work.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, he could play Donald, but maybe not Charlie. Nobody wants to see Tom Hanks play a loser.
Yeah, I don't think he would have pulled it off as well. Nicolas Cage has something about his face. He can be very good looking and strong and whatever, and be the kind of hero bad boy Con Air thing. But he can also appear very homely and very... He just does something with his posture or whatever. Like, he has a kind of duality about him that I don't know if Tom... Not that Tom Hanks is a heartthrob or anything, but I don't... I think it would have been a little more comedy if Tom Hanks did it. It wouldn't have been the same movie.
I think you're... Well, I definitely agree with that. And I think Cage, too, never really talked about this. A couple of years earlier, he was supposed to play Superman, right, for Tim Burton in that project that fell apart. And Superman, I'm less interested in that, but I would have loved to see his Clark Kent. I would have loved to see what he did with that.
Yeah.
Because it would have either been just a total craven caricature of humanity, like in Peggy Sue Got Married, where he's playing the loser that Kathleen Turner's character sees him as, and it's just this huge, ugly mess of neurosis. This is the closest we come with Charlie playing Clark Kent, essentially, and Donald being Superman, because ultimately he's the successful, supportive hero of the movie, even if Charlie doesn't think so.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why you get Cage for this, because, yeah, as you say, he can do both. He can make himself lovable and pathetic in the best sense of the word, but he'll also do whatever you ask of him. Like, he won't stop and worry about... Like, Tom Hanks, I really like Tom Hanks. He's an interesting person and a generous actor, but I don't think there's a way for this movie to work with him.
Yeah,
at least not as, yeah.
It's funny to picture things, though, after they're done. When you read on IMDb, so-and-so was considered for this role.
Right, right.
Oh, man, I couldn't picture that at all. It's always, for me, really hard to picture it. But that one, I really just can't. The whole thing, I can't picture with anybody else. Meryl Streep apparently was... This is... People listening are just going to be like, you just read the IMDb page. Yes, I did. But Meryl Streep was apparently on board right away. Read the script, said it's one of the best scripts I've ever read. I want to do this. Was willing to do it for no money or take a cut, take a pay cut. Which I find so cool as well. She just knows what's up. Nobody had to convince her or pull her arm. She's read it and went, this is different. This is cool. I can do this. This is going to be one of the best movies of the year. I just find that really interesting. And not that, oh, Chris Cooper and Nicolas Cage had to have their arms twisted to do it or anything. It's just one more thing that makes her just seem like such a smart actor, such a, just knows what's up all the time.
Yeah. It's just that thing, right? Like, you have enough money. You can do one for less money if you really believe in it.
Yeah. What was the thing? Nicolas Cage apparently... due to his gambling debt, or what was it?
I think he likes to buy castles and dinosaur bones.
Yeah.
Is that it?
So he either just spends too much money or gambles it away or whatever. Mm-hmm. But there was a time there where he said he would do any movie for $1 million, $5 million.
Helps him pay off the IRS.
Yeah. So, which is why he was doing for years these just really questionable roles.
Where he's like, wait, he's still doing this.
Right, yeah.
He's never really stopped.
So he's put the call out and said, I will do any movie if you just... This is my minimum. I'll do it, though. Just to, like...
Yeah.
Some of them are great.
Yeah, I almost respect that decision because, in a weird way, it's probably opened him up to more stuff than he would have been offered otherwise. And, yeah, and you get something like Joe, which is
Joe is great.
A tremendous performance, yeah.
Yeah, I like that movie a lot. And that kid who plays the kid...
Oh, Ty Sheridan.
He's a great... Great young actor, I think. He's really, really good. He's going to be, if he plays his cards right, a sort of Tom Hardy kind of good-looking guy that does good, like, takes interesting roles and, you know.
And he's in the new X-Men movies, so he can can afford to do the other stuff.
Yeah.
It's funny, we were talking about superhero movies a little while ago about how they are generic. They're sort of, it's true, all the Marvel movies up until recently have ended with a big thing falling out of the sky and everybody racing to stop it. But I at this point, I'm kind of fascinated by the machinery involved because they will end up, like you and I will be in one at one point, they will end up casting literally everybody. The same way everyone in downtown Toronto has probably been in Broken Social Scene at one point or another. We will all, just because the worlds keep expanding and the roles keep coming, and, you know, like Brie Larson is Captain Marvel now, and
right.
Somebody else just got cast in something, and like Lupita Nyong'o is in Black Panther, and they're going for interesting actors, and so now those people can make these movies and then make five other movies because now they're internationally known. John Boyega was telling me about making Detroit because he made The Force Awakens, and, you know, you're in Star Wars, you're marketable everywhere.
Right.
I assume it's got to be the same for Marvel and probably for DC now, too. So Ty Sheridan making all of these indies and then doing an X-Men movie or two, it's like, it can't be difficult. I mean, you know, you wear a silly goggle and you run around and you do stuff in front of a green screen.
Yeah.
And then you go home and you read other people's scripts and you make their movies. I, if nothing else, like, I'm really glad that the vehicles exist now. If we have to... split so clearly between gigantic blockbusters and indies and the middle ground has disappeared,
yeah,
then at least they're making those smaller movies possible, I guess.
Yeah.
Through financial deals.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But yeah, you're right. They're all kind of samey. They're all pretty
Yeah. Aside, you know, there's a couple. I liked Logan, I liked Deadpool enough. I liked the Guardians of the Galaxy movies because they're just a little more fun, funny, entertaining in ways. They do something slightly different.
Well, they try. Yeah, they're allowed to move outside this very specific tunnel
right.
that all of these others take place in.
Yeah, but those... And I guess when I was saying, like, oh, he'll do Tom Hardy caliber roles or whatever, yeah. But, I mean, and he played Bane.
He was Bane, exactly, movie, yeah.
But that's Christopher Nolan Batman. That's, like, almost... I don't even think of those as superhero movies, but... I don't know if an actor could do a movie... so crummy or so whatever that it's that big of a skid mark on their resume that, oh, I lost all respect for them. That's for sure. I mean, same with
yeah, they do that in real life now on Twitter. Yeah. Like that's where people destroy themselves.
Yeah, that's
true. You don't do it through your choices.
Yeah, stay off social media. That's probably the best advice. Elizabeth Olsen, I think she was talking about it on Fallon or something, and because she's another one that just chooses. Yeah. She's in a lot of very interesting, very cool movies, and I think she's fantastic. But she did that Marvel movie, and she was kind of, I could tell, she not begrudgingly does them, but it's, she kind of gave a pretty candid glimpse into what it is like to do them on Fallon. She was talking about, yeah, you just kind of, they spend like 2 days getting 5 seconds of footage of you moving your hands like this, and you just have to kind of like look and do this like 1,000 different ways.
Yeah.
And then they just cut it together. Like, it's not really acting. They're just kind of propping you up like a, she didn't say this, I'm putting words into her mouth now, but you could picture it being, you just get propped up like a doll. Hold, right. Do this. Okay. Now like a little bit more this way and do it again. And then there's not too much acting going on. There's not a lot of dialogue. It must be very strange to do those movies. But also like, yeah, why they get a nice paycheck. They work for a few months and then they can do whatever they want for the next couple of years.
Yeah. I do find it interesting though, to see actors. I mean, and this is the other thing. Is it actually a conscious choice when Jeremy Renner and Elizabeth Olsen, you know, Hawkeye and the Scarlet Witch, who have a rapport in Avengers, in Ultron anyway, they both end up as the leads in Wind River, and what are you talking about? You know, like, is it because one of you was reading the script on set and the other one just like, oh, this could be fun?
Yeah, I wonder.
And at that point, is that how these movies get made? Because now you can say, oh, I have these two actors and they're going to do it together. Or then you see something like Spotlight. That was the one I was talking to. I'm just dropping names left and right. I'm so sorry. Tom McCarthy came to TIFF for Spotlight, and he was talking about how they're not sure how to market it. And, you know, it ends up winning Best Picture and Best Screenplay and all of this stuff, but he's having his jitters, and it's like September and the film hasn't screened yet and he doesn't know how it's going to play. And it's like, just tell people you have like Batman, the Hulk, and there's one other major, Sabretooth, I guess, whoever Liev Schreiber plays in the Wolverine movies.
Oh, yeah.
It's like all of these guys have done superhero movies, and then subsequently Rachel McAdams is in Doctor Strange.
Okay.
Eventually, you can look at any movie and describe it as, oh, this is the one where Thor is Steve Trevor's father. And that's the first Star Trek movie, because they'll all have just interwoven each other.
Yeah.
They'll overwrite them. And now people will come up with, like, I hate fan theory, ultimately, because it gets in the way of me writing stuff. But I can see, you know, 10 years from now, people are going to write about how Spotlight is a movie where all of these superhero crossovers are happening, but they're all in their secret identities, and so they don't know. Whatever. Or someone will cut together a Superman movie with footage from Henry Cavill in some other movie, like all that stuff.
Right.
But yeah, Cage, he made 2 Ghost Rider movies,
mm-hmm.
and somehow made it okay, because he's having a ball. The movies aren't very good, but he is having a great time.
Maybe he's the ultimate example of that kind of actor. Like you were just saying, he does so many things that it opens him up to new kinds of roles, but yeah. He's done so much good and so much crap that it's, you can't throw shit at him. You can't
dismiss any of it.
Because he's done it all unabashedly. He's done it. He embraces all of that stuff. And, I mean, that's part of what being a working actor is. I like those kinds of actors who just work, you know? And they're just working. They're taking the work that comes while it's there. And they're making decisions, artistic decisions, when they can. But also, they're just kind of doing what's coming in the mail, and there's something really cool about that. And also, you have to be a versatile, strong actor to be able to take roles and go, I can make this work, like I can figure it out. And there's a lot of respect for somebody like, you gotta have a lot of respect for somebody like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he might be the ultimate example of somebody who has weathered enough storms to the point where now it's just, he can kind of do no wrong, really.
Yeah, he's got a film coming to TIFF that I'm dying to see. It's one of the Midnight movies in which he plays, if I read the synopsis correctly, because I try not to know too much, he is a parent of the film is about two kids, a brother and a sister, trying to stay alive after a virus devastates the adults and turns them against their children. And he and Selma Blair are their parents, who are apparently homicidal.
Okay.
And I'm really hoping that you don't cast Nicolas Cage to be a rage zombie. I'm hoping that he has dialogue and a character to play who is also trying to kill his kids. Because that's really interesting, and I'd love to see him do that. You know, yeah. Somebody who is... He doesn't play a lot of villains. I mean, he did... Like, he does at the beginning of Face Off, but then the rest of it is playing the Travolta character. And I like villain Cage. I like the guy who is incredibly charming and really wants to hurt you.
Man.
That's a fun role for him.
Yeah. Face Off was another one that I was considering talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Just because it's so, like...
It's a blast.
It is.
It really is.
It's...
Wow. It's like a masterclass in practical effects mania.
Oh, boy. It is... I don't know if it blew my mind so much, because it was another one that I saw when I was a boy. Mm-hmm. I don't know when it came out. Maybe I was 13. And processed it as one kind of movie, you know? Rewatched it a few years ago, and it blew my mind. I was like, this is one of the best movies ever made. It is so strange and so self-aware. It's like a B-movie with a huge budget. It's so, like... It's so unique. It's so awful, but good, but I don't know.
Well, it leans into its ludicrousness, right?
Yeah. Like,
it tells you right away, thanks to this drug, it's that line from Thank You for Smoking that Rob Lowe comes up with to sell cigarettes in a movie about space stations. I just invent a machine. You know, thanks to the blah, blah, now we can smoke in space. Here's a cigarette. And that's what they do here. It's like, thank you. Thanks to anti-inflammatories, healing takes hours instead of days. You can be someone else right away. And it's like, never mind that John Travolta has 100 pounds on this guy. And
yeah.
He's rounder and everything else is different. It's like, nope, okay.
Yeah.
And once you get that, like once you clear that hump, just as in adaptations, like, oh, there's two Nicolas Cages. Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Just go with that.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. Those are the kinds of continuity things that I usually get really hung up on. But I was, I don't care. And his that scene where has the priest's robes on.
Oh, the cathedral thing, yeah.
And he's like doing this dance thing, and it's like just ridiculous, but so awesome and works. And it's just, I don't know. It's like no movie. I don't know if there's anything really comparable to Face Off.
No, I don't think there should be.
Yeah.
No one has ever made another one or something like it. Even John Woo had trouble topping it.
Was it John Woo?
Yeah.
Does Michael Bay have anything to do with Face Off?
No, Michael Bay was not involved, which is why I think it is ludicrous and entertaining rather than just ludicrous the way Armageddon is.
Yes.
Which is just
noise. Yeah, exactly.
It's just noise.
Yeah.
Face Off is a blast. Face Off is fun and silly and things are exploding everywhere, but there's also a scene where a father tries to help his child while not being her father.
Right.
And it's like, that's a high wire act. I mean, the best movies are the ones that leave you and it's just like you were saying about adaptation. I can't believe someone thought of this. I can't believe someone made it, and I can't believe it works.
Yeah.
And Cage is the guy for that, I think. Sometimes you get a Wicker Man where it's a gamble and it just doesn't work at all.
Yeah.
But he committed anyway. Like, he's giving the performance that he thinks is appropriate. He's doing what his director asks of him. There's absolutely thought behind this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I truly believe nobody sets out to make a bad movie. They happen all the time. But no one really wants to do that.
Right.
And instead, you get these things where, they really wanted to make this Wicker Man about this thing. And it just doesn't, like, it just doesn't land. It doesn't work. Adaptation... I think everybody knew working on it that it was going to be like nothing else. You can sense that kind of... It vibrates with that energy. It's a really calm, placid film for most of its running time. It only gets crazy in the very end. It only gets frantic in the very end. But it knows how special it is while you're watching, I think.
Yeah.
I think you can feel it.
And it could have gone wrong if it were in the wrong hands. Oh, the wrong director did it, or if the wrong actor was cast in one of the... You know,
in any of
it could have gone... so wrong, because it really is. It had to be that combination or some close combination of those people that made it. Somebody like Spike Jonze, who gets the screenplay and knows how to execute it, like, so. And I don't know who the cinematographer was.
I can look it up on the app, it'll be easier.
Director of photography, Lance Accord.
Oh, right,
yeah.
I think he shot most of Jonze's films, hasn't he?
I don't know. These are things that I, as a pretty casual movie fan, sometimes pay attention to and sometimes have no idea, which is quite a shame. Doing a movie was something that I realized how vital a director of photography is, how important that is to have somebody that the director knows and trusts.
Mm-hmm.
And just how much say that person has. I mean, I kind of knew, but I didn't know. But yeah, very, very, very cool to... I mean, you need somebody that gets the vision, obviously. I don't think I knew that for a long time,
yeah.
How important that is. That the director isn't... Oh, the director is the king in the movie. The director does everything. They wrote it and they do all this. It's like, no, like it's a group effort, you know.
Yeah. I think films with kind of flat cinematography always tells me there weren't enough meetings. It always tells me that the vision wasn't communicated, like literally right. wasn't communicated, because unless you just don't care where the camera goes, you're going to have an idea
yeah.
of what you want your film to look like. And I just looked up Lance, I think it might be Acord, but he shot Where the Wild Things Are and Being John Malkovich, and he worked with Jones very closely. And yeah, just to pull off the twinning stuff, he has to know his details.
Right. Yeah, that's the... It's you can see it sometimes, but not in a way that you're... It's just in ways where they're probably limited in the technology.
Yeah, it's 2002 versus 2010. Like, when The Social Network was more sophisticated.
And I've seen stuff since, though, that tries to do that. It's called twinning.
Well, it depends on who's talking about it, but
the double actor thing. Yeah, I've seen stuff since then where you're just like, oh, that's pretty bad, the blocking there. They're not even looking at it. They waited too long. Like, the dialogue interaction is, to me, the most important. And then they do it so well, where it almost seems off the cuff. It seems like they are genuinely talking to each other and interrupting each other.
Yeah.
I was like, how many times do they have to rehearse that? How did they figure that out? Nicolas Cage in his head going, 1, 2, 3, like, before he gets interrupted, starts again, interrupted, and then starts again. It's so, so well blended and so flawless that it's like... Man, those details, those minute details in adaptation are crazy good. There's like one error. Not error, it's not even an error. You can't even call... That's the thing about adaptation that's brilliant too. You could never call anything an error, because the fact that there's one scene where he's talking in the mirror and you see Donald in the mirror in the background is small.
Yeah.
And it's clearly someone... It's like, doesn't even look at all.
Yeah, stand-in.
Right. But even then, you're like, well, but it's... You know, you're aware that it doesn't matter. Like, there's no... That's, like, the only tiny technical error that I could ever spot, though. But just as a filmmaking film, it's just so good, too. Like, all those technical things. Like,
yeah, it is. It's just... It's... I always... I don't know why I'm repeatedly dazzled by Spike Jonze being as good a filmmaker as he is. I think it's because he makes a different movie every time. Like, it's a radical departure... this is different from Being John Malkovich, where The Wild Things Are is completely tonally, and I mean, I love it so much.
Me too.
You can't put it next to this film, and I don't think people would know it was the same guy. And then Her, which is another kind of magnificent science fiction film that isn't a science fiction film, really, because it's so recognizably us and different, but just... It's a mirror instead of a window into the future. It's just looking right back at us right now, and insecurities, and also step back, and it's about the birth of a new life form. I mean, it's just,
yeah,
it's there. It's all there, and it's told so in such a I keep underestimating him, and then I start thinking, am I underestimating the movies? Is this guy one of the best American filmmakers going? And I think he might be.
I think so.
I'm just fascinated by it.
Not to mention some pretty sweet music videos.
That's true. Yeah. If he had done nothing but Weapon of Choice, really.
Oh, wow.
It is fascinating. But and he started as a skateboarder who just picked up a camera for fun.
Yeah.
That's the thing that stuns me, is that he's a savant. And maybe that's it. You know, to break the rules as Kaufman, the real Charlie Kaufman, does, and then to show us how well you understand them by having Donald. Like, Jones is that guy.
Mm-hmm.
He has... Like, I think he just feels movies.
Yes.
And knows what's right and what's wrong and how you can bend it.
Yeah.
And it's just, you get this. You get something like, you get somebody who believes in the script enough to do it like this. And whew.
Yeah. And it just, it's a brilliant collaboration. Two brilliant minds that get each other. And I'm surprised they didn't just keep doing it.
Yeah.
But I guess you can't keep a bird caged. You got to let that birdie fly. Charlie Kaufman had to step out and start doing his own thing.
Yeah.
I'm glad he did, because...
Synecdoche and Anomalisa are just so...
I need to revisit Synecdoche
Synecdoche,
I need to revisit that. I saw it in theaters and I loved it, and I haven't seen it since. I need to give that one another go, but...
Oh, it's great.
I remember really liking it. But one as well where you're watching it and it's kind of unfolding and you're kind of, you leave the theater like, I don't know what I just saw entirely, but I liked it a lot. I need to watch it again.
Absolutely, yeah. It's great. I saw it at Cannes. It was like the second last thing they showed at that festival in competition, for, or at least in terms of the press schedule. I saw that at, I don't know, I want to say 8:30 in the morning. It was the first thing that day, and it was just, oh, it was so good, and I was so tired that I could fully absorb it.
Yeah.
Like, all my resistance was down, and it just came right in through the optic nerves. And it's, and having revisited it, I'm still sure I love it.
Right.
But it's, yeah, it demands everything of you. Mm. And now it's even sadder with Philip Seymour Hoffman being gone, because the whole film is about death.
Right.
But, oh, it's so good. Yeah. And he's, again, he knows what he wants. He knows what kind of story he's telling, and he finds a way to communicate it through the subtext of the dialogue and through a camera angle, mm-hmm. to tell you what you're seeing and how it's going to affect you. And then with Anomalisa to do it with puppets, to just find another way. It's amazing.
Yeah. With every voice being the same actor.
Yeah. Which is the best, almost the best use of Tom. If it wasn't for Manhunter, it would be the best use of Tom Noonan, because it's so, it's disquieting without you knowing why it's disquieting. It's, mm-hmm. just like, why isn't everyone so calm? It just builds the paranoia. It's great.
Yeah, yeah.
So this basically brings us to the end of the last question of the podcast, which is always the same, which is, if anything, and I'm really curious to hear the answer in terms of music as well as acting, what, if anything, of adaptation have you borrowed or lifted or referenced or stolen or incorporated into your own creative DNA?
I think a lot. I think absorbed a lot. Mm-hmm. Watching it again, I was sort of like, this is very much the path, and this is very, very presumptuous of me to say, I don't consider myself Charlie Kaufman of music at all. Like, I need to be clear about that. I don't think I'm doing some new thing and I'm like this most innovative guy that nobody knows about or anything like that. But there's something about those scenes where he's struggling to write that resonate with me so much. He writes about writing really, really well. It can be very boring. Oh, a screenwriter writing a movie about a writer.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, there's a lot of that. And he does it so well. He just, the struggle and the challenge of writing, and how when it's really good, it doesn't necessarily mean that it came easily. You know, the work that you put into it and just waiting for something to happen, he captures so well. And sitting there in the even just the little things that, because I think almost every time I sit down to write, I think of that little scene where he's sitting in his weird chair and his weird typewriter that, like, why does he set it up like that? But he's sitting hunched over, and I think, okay, I'm going to write. Maybe I should get a coffee. Maybe I should write a page and then get a coffee as a reward and a muffin. And then he has another thought, banana nut.
Yeah,
that's a good muffin. Like, I think of that almost every time. I'm sitting there looking at my computer, my guitar, and thinking about writing, and like, I don't know, just how fruitless that can be, how pointless. And then, but you do it for those moments when he's just elated and he has a smile on his face and he's manically speaking into his tape recorder, and it's just, there's this idea that's flowing through him and he's so excited. And then cut to the just the falling off a cliff doubt that follows that, of that's so stupid, like, how did I ever think I could write this? And taking on something that's bigger than you, and how do you write a song? How do you write a movie? How do you do anything? It's such a big thing to challenge that so many other people are doing. What makes you deserving to do that? What makes you deservative of that? But you still do it somehow. Somehow you find a way to do it despite all of those things, and you somehow put it out there, and, you know, you hope that people listen to it. It just represents that, the creative arc of making something, more than anything else I could imagine. It's like a seminar. It's a masterclass in writing, in going for it, in sticking with it. It's just, yeah, it's very inspiring. It's such a good, and it's still, it's, it's still the same. It's still very much the same lessons being learned over and over for me. I will continue to learn those same lessons over and over with every album I do and everything, you know, and refining it. But it's those same lessons over and over. Mm. If, like, just stick to it and try and get past your own self-doubt and let it find a way. Let that art find a way through you. And yeah.
So you're more of a Charlie than a Donald.
I hope so. I don't know. Maybe the jury's out on that. That's the fear, honestly, right? Though, the fear is, am I Donald or am I Charlie?
Yeah.
And does it matter? That's another great... Yeah. With my music, I go back and forth so much. You know, am I cool? Am I not cool? Am I mainstream? Am I not mainstream? Am I a failed radio rock musician? Am I doing something more artsy than some of my contemporaries that... You know, what is my place in this? Like, the Donald Charlie duality that everybody has, mm-hmm. I think, to an extent, no matter what you do, we've all got those two guys in us. I mean, some people less than others. Some people maybe don't ever think such disparaging thoughts about themselves, but I don't know. I think we all have those two people in us, and which one you are, and I guess we're all both, and you're just trying to figure out how much of which one to use at any given time, maybe, you know?
Hmm. Yeah. I would like to believe that every artist has self-doubt, because mm-hmm. that would make them try. Mm-hmm. You know, that would force somebody to better themselves. It's the ones who are all Donald, or at least who front themselves as all Donald, that are terrifying, because
yes.
they scare me. I don't...
Me too. There are some... There's certainly some all Donalds out there that I perceive as full... Yeah. Pure Donald. Yeah. Or worse, because... You know, because Donald is likable too, but there's some people that are like, they just don't appear to think about anything other than making that pop hit or that, without any lyrical relevance, without anything innovative or interesting. And when it works, you're just like, ah. And movies like that too. Just full Donald movies. all I can think of now is Donald Trump.
Yeah,
he's the ultimate Donald.
The ultimate Donald. He is basically, he's accomplished everything that a Donald would want to accomplish, and look where it got him.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what's scary. You watch those guys win. You watch those bullies win. And you feel those, watching him, and I don't want to get too into Trump now. Yeah. Obviously, this is the end of the podcast.
Well, but who knows, like, this is coming out almost a week from when we record it. Who knows what will happen?
When you think it can't get worse, it gets worse, but...
You might not be president anymore. That'd be nice.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I don't know.
Yeah, I know. Nothing's going to stop this guy.
Yeah.
My thanks to Luc Lalonde, who you can see making his acting debut in Pavanmundi Sundowners when it opens at TIFF Bell Lightbox in Toronto this Friday, August 25th. And you can check out his music and his art at luclalonde.com. You can find Luc on Twitter at Luc Lalonde, all one word, and you can find Adaptation on Blu-ray and DVD from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play, and it would be really nice if Criterion gets around to it now that they're licensing stuff from Sony again. Just saying. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner, and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, that would be very kind of you. Just don't steal any orchids this week. Thanks for listening.